one member.
Good afternoon, everyone. The committee, subcommittee on waters will come to order this, I guess it's March 23rd. Welcome. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 880, Senator Stumpf. Senator Stumpf.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. We have a good-sized crew that came.
I was going to say, you brought the whole town.
They dropped their sandbags and came down to talk to some of our colleagues. So I'm going to leave most of the talking to them. My voice isn't very good right now, but there's a program that's been in play for a long time up in the Red River Valley, and it's called River Watch, which is quite appropriate right now when the Red River is rising and threatening a number of the communities. But it's for a different purpose. The River Watch program that we bring to you is a program to monitor the quality of the water, and it solicits a lot of different organizations and a lot of different resources, in particular a lot of our high school science programs that participate in helping young people learn about how to keep our environment clean and how to learn the scientific processes of nature and also pollution. So with that, a question that we were talking about before was, well, why do we want to come to this committee? And I think the solution was that I just came from a finance chair's meeting, and all of the other committees are reducing budgets, cutting budgets, and we feel that this is such a good program that, and you have a few dollars, I think, that this is something that we'd like you to consider. So with that, I think we have, Madam Chair, do you have the list of
I do, Senator Stumpf. I have Mr. Wayne Gekin.
Yes.
Yep.
And Gary Knotts or Kotz.
Kotz, yes.
Ayala Winskowski. Heidi Erickson. And Chuck Fritz. So I don't know, have you got a sequence in which you want to make your presentation? And if you do, all you need to do is give your name for the record and tell us what part of the presentation you're going to cover.
Okay, I'll start out. Madam Chair, I'm Wayne Gokin, the Red River Watershed Management Board Monitoring Coordinator, and I'll give a little background about the program, and then I'll turn it over to the Gary and students to give their perspectives on the River Watch program. Just a little background on the River Watch program. It started in 1995 as a need of a local watershed district, a small watershed, the Sandhill Watershed in northwest Minnesota, for data for a particular project. And they had nothing on their books at the time, and so we started this program, a citizen monitoring program, with the assistance of the Mississippi Headwaters Board at that time to start it up. And we started providing good quality data for decision-making is what was needed, and it also provided local hands-on science opportunities for students in their own backyards, looking at conditions of their local rivers and streams. And from that humble beginnings in 95 with four schools, we expanded the program in the year 2000 with the Board of Water and Soil Resources Challenge Grant to schools in the northern part of the basin, and that was about $100,000 that we received at that time for that expanded program. And subsequent to that, to this day now, and through the 2008 monitoring season, we moved to the southern part of the basin, down to the Wheaton area in Graceville, and we have now 25 schools in the program and monitoring over 160 sites, and we have enough data for doing water quality assessments that fit into the PCA's TMDL process and such. So it's one of the strengths of the programs has been the sound science that's emphasized, and we have a monitoring network of partners in the Red River Basin that does the training in the springtime, and we follow standard operating procedures at all of our partners, from the watersheds, from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So it's a very strong partnership that we've developed that makes all this happen for the data collection and sharing of equipment and standards for calibrations. And so it's really quite a seamless program between the different entities. And then we coordinate on our monitoring sites so we don't have, you know, minimize duplication and find areas that are currently not addressed. So it's been quite a strong program. We just had our Riverwatch Forum last week up in the University of Minnesota Crookston, where all the schools get together, and about 200 students on campus sharing their information about what their results are in their streams, looking at current issues and doing some training on future directions we'd like to go with the program. And some of those future directions would be made possible if we were to be fortunate enough to receive funding to expand the program. We've certainly had demand from other schools that have asked about monitoring, getting involved in the program, but just limited resources right now to expand that effort. The local watershed districts are, I should say the Red River Watershed Management Board is the coalition of the watershed districts in the Red River Basin, and they've been supporting the staffing and support the schools through their efforts. But then we also have individual watershed districts that provide support. They oftentimes provide funding support directly to the schools to cover their transportation costs to go out to do the monitoring, substitute teacher costs when the teachers are out of school for the day. So that minimizes the burden to the schools to allow that participation. And when we get to the forum, when the students present these wonderful presentations, scientifically backed, it's really quite powerful to see what they can do given the opportunity. And the rigor of the program, that scientific quality, is really paramount to getting acceptance by our Minnesota Pollution Control Agency partners and others so that the data is credible, is acceptable for use in decision-making. And some of the other partners that we have, the University of Minnesota Crookston has helped us develop an online database that's an interactive data system so anybody can access the data. It can be used for research possibilities. It's something that we're looking to expand that as well as we look into the research component. We've had some really strong schools that have been partners, and the Stephen Argyle school is certainly one of them. And we've had a strategic leadership team that has met over the past couple years with the assistance of the Northwest Regional Sustainable Partnership has provided funding for that initiative. And through that strategic leadership team, which includes students, teachers, administration, resource managers in the basin, so it's a good coalition of people that are involved and interested in water issues in the Red River Basin, we've come up with a kind of a three-part strategy that we're trying to advance, and that's to develop more of a curriculum integration that we're looking at to integrate Riverwatch into the school curriculum more directly. It's essentially an extracurricular activity now where the students go out once a month collecting samples at up to generally about an average of 5 to 8 sites per school, but integrate it directly into the curriculum across the grade spans and across subject areas as well. And the second component of that that we're aiming for is for youth engagement and youth leadership and civic and community engagement, is utilizing the youth, providing them more skills to do community engagement. Already some of the schools provide presentations within their community and do different workshops and do different opportunities within the communities, but there's a lot of opportunity we see for enhancing that possibility. And then the third component is an applied research, and we're particularly working with the University of Minnesota Crookston again, and helping us kind of work through some study design. They have a university research opportunity program that undergrads are all involved with, and so we would utilize undergrads to work with our Riverwatch students and resource managers, and the idea there is to develop very sound, credible research projects that are applied research that are applicable to needs in the Red River Basin, issues that we're seeing in watershed management. And then the students would help us share that back into the communities and with the resource managers. So those are the emphases that we're going after, and we feel the clean water legacy, the citizen engagement, community involvement aspects are certainly quite fitting for the direction we'd like to go with the Riverwatch program. Building on the strong foundation we've established to this point and taking it kind of to the next level, both expanding in terms of geographic coverage to more schools that have expressed interest in the program, but also as a enhancing the type of activities we would like to do with the program. So I think with that, I'll turn it over to Gary Kotz, the science teacher at Stephen Argyle.
Before we do that, sure. Are there any questions for Mr. Gokin? Maybe this will come up in later testimony. I'm particularly curious about kinds of assessment. What are the students evaluating the waters for? And also, I'm not familiar with the geography up there. It sounds like you began with the Sandhill watershed, and the Red River Basin is much larger than that, I take it, and there are a number of watersheds that you've expanded to.
Right. There's 8 watersheds that make up the Red River Watershed Management Board. On the back side of one of the handouts that was provided, there's a map of the basin and the Sandhill, and it isn't broken out by watersheds, but the Sandhill is right in the middle. It's a small watershed and includes the Climax, Fertile, Erskine, and Fauston area. And then we expanded to the north to the other watersheds, to the Red Lake, the Middle River, Snake, Tamarack, Two Rivers, and Roseau, and then to the south into the Buffalo Red and the Bois de Sioux watershed. Where we have the gaps where you see maybe the schools, what we label as potential schools, those tend to be in the Otter Tail watershed where there's not an organized watershed. That's been a stumbling block. And so we'd like to see this be a model program for the state. And so this would be a challenge for us to how to work in those areas that don't have an established watershed. But we have some strategies we have in mind to work with local soil and water conservation districts and some other partners that we've identified, sportsmen's clubs and such in some of those areas that might be partners to help make this happen.
And $273,000, do you anticipate how many additional schools you could get to or how many additional areas? Do you have any sense of that?
We certainly don't anticipate we're going to be getting all of these schools involved with the program. This would not cover that. We're hoping maybe 5 schools per year that we may expand to, both within the areas where we have established schools. And some of the schools are, we tend to have a transition of schools. Some drop out now and then when teachers turn over. And so some of those are looking to come back into the fold this upcoming year. But there are some schools in that Otter Tail area in particular that have asked about getting involved with the program, but we just haven't had resources to expand. The resources that have been committed will certainly stay there, but we're looking to expand to additional geographic areas.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just wanted to add that we heard this about this program in our committee, too. We had significant testimony. There was science. What this basically mirrors is the PCA's citizen monitoring program. But the special thing that it adds is that it's not just a resource interest anymore. It adds on an educational interest. In an area where we desperately need it, it adds involvement for young people in the outdoors. It involves young people in the knowledge of their environment, which is basically the most critical thing to any policy we're considering, is the understanding of the people about the needs for what we do. And then on top of that, we're generating future scientists, future biologists, engineers. And so this is what can really be a model for our future, not just lake associations monitoring their own lake for the purposes of their self-interest, which is a good one, but now we're creating a real culture of interest and importance of Minnesota's water in our, you know, truly in our culture, in our future. And that's a real change. It's a real change. And it's an incredible one, and we really have these people to thank for initiating it. And it, because it's about cleaning up our water, direct data to our TMDL efforts and other things, we just had the opportunity here to give back so much more. And I just think it's it's incredible what you all are doing, and if you had the capacity, I would propose to fund it more, but one step at a time. And I just think we need to really reinforce these types of efforts. And more, and we're fortunate to have you all do it. Wish we could do, and hopefully this will expand in the future to the rest of the state, metro area, everywhere. And schools are doing it here and there, but this is really something that we really need to support.
Great,
and fits square within our charge in this committee.
Yes, Mr.
Madam Chair, as Senator Chaudhary mentioned, we are mirror somewhat the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program. All of our Riverwatch volunteers are part of that program as well, so all of our data goes into that. But we also add quite a bit more data than what that program collects. You asked about what do we monitor for, and we have dissolved oxygen and turbidity, pH, temperature, conductivity, do observations, stage levels, and the transparency tube, and that's what the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program uses. But these other parameters are stuff that they don't generally get into. We use each school is set up, the equipment they use is about $5,000 worth of equipment, and it's the same equipment that our resource partners utilize, professionals. And so these students are gaining some skills that and using equipment that they might not have access to even in college. In fact, we've had college professors borrow our equipment to fulfill their programs that they don't have access to. So it really is quite an opportunity, and the STEM skills. And we've had testimonials from students that have gone through the program. They've gone into science based on the beginnings they had in the Riverwatch program, the interest it provided.
Mr. Kotz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is quite an experience for myself and my two students. We're all a little bit nervous. This is new to us. I've been teaching high school biology in Stephen and then Stephen-Argyle, Minnesota, which if you look on your map is about as far north and west as you can get from where we're at right now. It's been a long day. We left at 7:30 this morning, and we got here about 2:30. And so it's been quite a trip, and we've seen a lot of water. I've been teaching for 25 years up there, and I can say without hesitation that the Riverwatch program, which we've been involved with the last 10 or 11 years, has provided opportunities for my students that I would never have been able to give them, and opportunities like speaking to you today for these two fine young ladies. We've done a lot of things up in Stephen-Argyle. We've spoke at three international water conferences in Winnipeg and Grand Forks, in Moorhead. My kids have done a lot of things. We've made a 30-minute Prairie Public TV video that we did all the editing and all the shooting. So we had a lot of great opportunities, and it's been because of Riverwatch. And so I would like my students to give you just a little bit of an idea of some of the things we've done in the last couple years that might be of interest to you, and more so on how it's affected them, but also other areas in our school. It's kind of some outreach activities that we've had a lot of success with. So with that, I will introduce or have them introduce themselves, sir.
Thank you. I am Ayla Winskowski, a senior at Stephen-Argyle.
Get closer to the mic.
Sorry. Ayla Winskowski, I'm a senior at Stephen-Argyle, and it's my third year in Riverwatch. And
I'm Heidi Erickson, a senior at Stephen-Argyle, and it's also my third year in Riverwatch.
And I'm going to prompt them a little bit. So I would like them to tell you a little bit, first of all, about our summer science camp that we have been running.
Summer science camp, I think we've done for 4 years now, if I'm correct, and Heidi and I have worked at them for 2 years. And it's our fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, which they generally have school in Argyle, which is 10 miles away from Stephen, and they come to Stephen, and we just do a bunch of projects. And, like, us Riverwatch students, we provide help. I mean, we do a bunch of things. Like, we taught them GPS, geocaching, just compasses, bottle rockets, just a lot of science activities. And then we go to our Old Mill State Park and bring them out to the river, and they get to go out and see all the macroinvertebrates and in the rivers, and they get nets and, you know, look under the microscopes and see how neat they are.
And then they also do nature photography, and that's really interesting, just to go out in the nature and just take all these cool pictures. They do the River of Dreams with the canoes. They, like, make their own canoes, and then they go and throw them in the rivers, and then you can check on them and see how far they made it.
Also, adopt a river is when you take a section of the river. They've done that past years, and, you know, clean up the rivers and
you have any questions on the summer science?
I would certainly suggest that you are maximizing your resources in these young people and the influence of the educational experience. And I'm delighted to hear that you have both photography and the science, putting the, you know, the right brain and the left brain together as students experience the...
One of the things that has been a real selling point to the... And we're a small school. We have 30 kids per grade. And so when we started this 4 years ago, we didn't know how many kids, and we had 10. We thought that was pretty good. You know, fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, it's in the summer, you know, so giving up some summertime for it. Last year we had 34, you know, so it's grown. That's a pretty good percentage of our fourth, fifth, and sixth graders in this. They love the canoeing. The nature photography is amazing. You know, we have lots and lots of pictures in our halls that the kids have taken. They take a lot of pride and ownership in those pictures, and it's pretty amazing what they can do. You put a digital camera in the hands of a fifth grader and you get some fantastic photos. So we've done quite a few of those types of activities. They do rocketry, you know, and so it's a good 4 days. We went from 3 days for about 5 hours, now we're to 4 days at about 6 hours. And so we're filling it up, and every year we try to add something different. Some other things, like I said, we did a 30-minute Prairie Public TV video. We were part of a National Science Foundation grant for 3 years, which allowed us some funds to purchase our GPSs and some cameras and green screen technology. We've made some educational presentations for the Riverwatch forums using that technology, and it's pretty amazing, you know, what high school kids can do with technology. I can't do it, and I know that, and they know that, and I just let them do things. And that's part of what my goal in Riverwatch is to provide opportunities for the students that they probably wouldn't get any other way. And so watching Ayla teach junior high and some senior high kids, as well as our summer science kids, and how to use GPS and do geocaching is a pretty amazing thing. You know, and it fits right along with the opportunities. So we've done a lot of things, and I guess we'd be open to any questions. Ayla will explain geocaching.
Geocaching is fun. It's kind of like a game in a way. You set some sort of a prize, and then you take coordinates or take your compass, and you say 160 yards to the northwest, and they walk their steps, you know, so many feet, and then they find that prize. So it teaches them, you know, how to use a compass, and then at the end there's a reward to it. So, and then, oh, GPS too. Last year, I tried to teach them GPS. A little bit difficult to teach 4th, 5th, and 6th grade GPS, but taught them how to use it and to find things also. So.
And I have a question. Is it Miss Winskowski?
Winskowski.
Winskowski. Are you planning to be a teacher?
Not really, but I'm thinking the science biology department, but I'm not sure yet.
It sure sounds like you've got a gift for that.
Oh, thank you.
Any other comments, Mr. Kotz? Any questions for Mr. Kotz or the students? Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, as long as we've asked one of the students what she's going to do, what about Heidi? What are you planning on doing?
I'm planning on going into radiology.
Good.
Very good. Other questions?
Can I add just one other thing? This in Stephen Argyle, and I think a lot of the schools are a little bit different. It's a volunteer It's something we do before school. The students will do it in the summer. And so it's not like a class that we have. And we have 9 students right now that are involved that were part of the forum that Mr. Golkin talked about at UMC last week. And so it's something above and beyond. So you get those students that are interested, and it's kind of fun to let them, you know, take off and run with some of these different activities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, your school district really caught my attention because your school district and myself have something in common. We have the same first name.
Mr. Fritz, did you have some ideas you wanted to share with us?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chuck Fritz. I'm the director of the International Water Institute. My role in all this is really to kind of try to coordinate and be the umbrella organization. I am blessed and privileged to be involved in many water-related activities in the Red River Basin, and things are rather tense right now. But I constantly tell my board and members of the Tri-College Board that if I had to spend $1 on one thing in the Red River Basin, I'd spend it on River Watch. And there are a number of reasons why, and you've heard some of them, but there are a few things in my career that I've had to be involved with or had the privilege of being involved with that are as rewarding as watching students like the young testifiers that we have here and all of the others. And it is truly a remarkable program that is worthy of so much more. And so thank you for your time.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time and the long drive that you took. We've talked a lot about the educational value of Riverwatch. Can someone speak to the value it adds to the work in cleaning up the rivers and waters in specifics? I mean, I understand you have created a database that will be used to help make plans for the watershed district.
So the information that, Madam Chair, the information that we have collected certainly is available for decision making, and that's why we really emphasize the sound science, so that it is good quality data that decisions can be made on. But to get into the critical thinking and getting into the research component of to what is the most effective best management practices that we want to do on the land, and to get the citizens involved with discussing that and agreeing that this is the best strategy to move forward with. And there's been certainly some of the watersheds that have had problems getting projects on the ground, get going, and we feel that through the citizens, that through the Riverwatch teams working with their families and friends and such, that we can kind of bridge that gap in knowledge and understanding of how our ecosystems and watersheds work and bring this data into more of that critical thinking, decision-making mode, so that there are sound decisions made on sound data. And and that's one of the reasons why our watersheds have supported this program also, not just from the education side of things, but that they look around the table and they see a lot of gray-haired old men that are needing young leadership in their folds, and they definitely need some Riverwatch talent to come up through the ranks and provide that. So we do feel that it's going to be providing that good data for decision making, and also our data has been used and will continue to be used in the TMDL process, but we're also looking at finding sites that are pristine and good quality and keep them that way, and looking at sites that are least impacted and make sure that those are maintained instead of always looking for problems down the line that have to be fixed. So let's maintain what we have first so we don't have to get into expensive fixes down the line.
I noticed that the bill specifies that the dollars be given to the Pollution Control Agency, and will they then pass them on to you? Is that the understanding, that we have to give them an earmark where to use this money? Senator Chavez, how do you understand that?
According to the bill language.
Madam Chair,
well,
members of the committee.
Madam Chair, you could probably do it a couple of ways.
This is under the citizen monitoring.
I don't see. I mean, you could do it through the Pollution Control Agency, or it could be directly to the Red River Watershed Management Board. So it just kind of depends on what the process is, and I guess as we discuss this more, we can get those details from you. But we could, if I'm not wrong, Mr. Mueller, one of the options could also be directly to the watershed board.
We'll let our financial people figure that out.
Sure.
We do have in the water budget a section for education, and would probably fit in there, and how that gets distributed we'll figure out. Is there anyone who wants to?
Excuse me, Madam Chair and members of the committee. What we're focusing on is citizens monitoring here, and I guess that's the program, and that's why we kind of identified the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency as the recipient of these funds.
Looking for smarter people than I am to speak up. What will probably happen, if no one at the table objects, is that we will have somebody move this bill to be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the water omnibus bill.
Move that.
Senator Anderson?
Sure, I'll
move that. Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 880 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair. Before we vote, I just thought of one other thing. Since you've got the biology science teacher here, before you leave, you might want to take a walk around the outside of this room and note Governor Carlson's picture, because he's the only governor in the Capitol here that's got butterflies in his picture. And he's also the only governor that's got a bird in it. And then if you go around the corner, you'll see Governor Quay's picture. And he's the only one, he's one of only two governors that has horses in his picture. Governor Tye from the 1940s is down at the end of the hall on the next first floor. He's got draft horses in his picture. And then if you go a little further around the corner, you'll see the only governor with a spouse in the picture, Governor Perpich. And if you double back over here, you'll see the only governor that's smoking, and that's Governor Ventura.
On that, is there any discussion on the motion to lay the bill on the table? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Stump. And thank you all of you for coming so far. I certainly appreciate it. Good luck with the weekend and the storms. We will be thinking
you.
About you.
I think
you.
We'll need it.
The next item on the agenda is Senate File 1249. Is Senator Gimsey here? Yes, he is. Senator Gimsey, welcome to the subcommittee.
Rigging things up here, I think I'll go ahead and get started, Madam Chair. Thank you, and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present to you Senate File 1249. Senate File 1249 is a bill that we've discussed before in some fashion, not this exact fashion, 2 years ago. And appreciate very much your allowing us to bring this version of it back to you. I'm just going to give a little bit of background as far as the importance of Green Lake to Candiota County and to our region of the state. It's our biggest lake in the area. The water from a huge watershed district goes through this lake, and it's a very important part of the community focus, and a lot of our events in the area happen around Green Lake, our 4th of July, you know, our winter festivals. And as you'll see through the testimony from the folks that are here today, they put together a very comprehensive plan and have been working on this for, I would say, about 7 years. And this pilot project, I believe, has all of the components that we should be looking for and that we are actually looking for in a project of this type. This project has specifics as far as what we hope to attain. The implementation is done by both professionals in cooperation with volunteers. It's government and it's private folks coming together, and the goals are measurable. And you'll see at the end of the bill, by January 15th of 2012, there's a requirement for a report on what has happened with this project and what the results are. And I really believe, as do the people who are here today, believe that the aspects of this project will be able to be used by other people all around the state in our efforts to have clean water and also to control Eurasian water milfoil, and that's our hope. And with that, I'll introduce Greg Roverud, who is the president of the Green Lake Property Owners Association, and I'll let our testifiers tell the story.
Mr. Roverud.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey and Madam Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Greg Roverud. I am the chairman of the Green Lake Property Owners Association in Spicer, Minnesota. This organization has over 500 dues-paying households around Green Lake. It's the city of Spicer is a town of 1,100 people, and it sits on 3 miles of Green Lake's 12 miles of shoreline. I and three of my colleagues will present a 15-minute briefing about Green Lake and how we believe you can help us. We are here today to highlight two ecological problems with Green Lake. The first problem is that Eurasian water milfoil was discovered in the lake in 2000, and it is spreading more and more each year, despite our successful treatment efforts. The second problem is the need to reduce stormwater inlet pollution, which is feeding the milfoil and causing water quality degradation from increased levels of phosphorus, nitrate, and sediment. In many places, what once was a sandy bottom is now weedy. What were clean shoreline rocks are now green with algae. I would still describe Green Lake as a healthy lake, but it is at risk of becoming impaired, and we are concerned about that. The Property Owners Association has for a number of years treated the milfoil with approved herbicides and has used scuba divers to remove certain milfoil stands. We have also been active in trying to ensure that stormwater runoff is handled better through improved storm drain design, particularly now with the new road construction in progress along the South Shore. Last summer, concerns about stormwater runoff in the city of Spicer led the property owners to approach the city council about two specific runoff areas that were causing particular pollution concerns. The council agreed with our concerns and proposed that the council join with the property owners and the watershed district to form a partnership to address the concerns we all have. This in turn resulted in an association with other entities, and we are now known as the Inlet Partnership Group. The Inlet Partnership Group met for the first time in October 2008. It now includes representation from the Green Lake Property Owners Association, the City of Spicer, the Watershed District, Kandiyohi County, Minnesota DNR, and Minnesota DOT. For years, each organization has been doing what it thinks is right to protect Green Lake, but I believe individual organizations cannot succeed in isolation. With the creation of the Inlet Partnership Group, we now have a cooperative movement of many diverse entities whose synergy has already helped us make progress towards solving the two problems I've mentioned and other problems we face. This progress would not have occurred without the partnership. The solutions to the problems of sedimentation, nutrient pollution, and the increase of milfoil cost more than the combined budgets of the partners. Therefore, we respectfully seek your approval of our request for clean water funds for a 2-year period to help us attack the problems. At the end of that time, we will provide you with documentation of the projects completed and the results obtained, with the hope that our plan will prove to be a successful model for other areas of the state. Our volunteer work and agency efforts have accomplished a lot, but we can accomplish even more with your financial assistance and your philosophical support of our plan. To talk more specifically about our plan, Jay Michaels, our contract engineer, and Chad Anderson from the Watershed District will brief you, followed by a summation by Ron Schneider, a property owner and partnership member. Here's Jay.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Jay Michaels, and located in Kandy, Ojai County. The Green Lake is a central Minnesota gem. Its 5,400 acres are literally the lifeblood of the city of Spicer. It's an economic and recreational driver for Kandy, Ojai County and all of central Minnesota. It's provided generations of memories for both permanent and summer homeowners. Fishermen flock to its water. Even in the winter, it's a mecca of activity. But Green Lake has a problem. It's called Eurasian water milfoil. Since it was first discovered in the year 2000, the frequency of occurrence has increased from 4% in 2004 to 20% in 2008. Eurasian water milfoil has a dramatic effect on water quality. Plant sloughing and decomposition of this material increases phosphorus and nitrogen in the water column, and the density of the mats alter water quality by raising the pH, decreasing oxygen under the mats, and increasing water temperature. But the root of the problem can be attributed to stormwater runoff. To understand the challenge, we need to know a little bit about how development affects receiving waters. In a natural setting, very little of the rainfall that hits the earth runs off, less than 10%. Most is infiltrated and used by the plants through evapotranspiration. The rest evaporates, which completes what's known as the water cycle. But with the coming of development and the impervious surfaces associated with development, this equation completely flip-flops. What used to soak into the ground now runs off, leading to our first problem, which is water quantity impacts. Our floods are higher, they last longer, causing stream bank and channel erosion and associated habitat loss. So automatically, as we increase the water quantity, we decrease water quality. Then come the pollutants of concern, or non-point source pollutants as they're known. These are nutrients, pathogens, sediment, toxins, and other pollutants that create the number one water quality problem in the United States today. In the case of Green Lake, we're primarily concerned with nutrients and sediment. Individually, both of these are pollutants on their own. But these two are special because the phosphorus will attach itself to the sediment particle, which, once in suspension, becomes the vehicle to move the phosphorus through the watershed. In recent years, increased residential and commercial development and highway and road improvements and the associated impervious surfaces have had a direct effect on 32 inlets around the lake. These inlets bring a significant amount of sediment and nutrients into Green Lake with every rainfall. A strong correlation can be made between the location of these inlets and the establishment of Eurasian water milfoil. I'd like to draw your attention to the picture on the lower left of this slide. The silt shown on the shovel is covering an area that 3 years earlier was a hard sand bottom. The silt accumulation has accelerated the development of Eurasian water milfoil in this area of the lake.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, rest of the members of the committee. My name is Chad Anderson. I'm the administrator of the Middle Fork Crow River Watershed District. Water quality issues in and around Green Lake have been thoroughly studied, both before the establishment of the Watershed District in 2005 and after. This includes annual lake surveys conducted by the DNR, a Clean Water Partnership Phase 1 study, water quality monitoring, and others. Without going into too much detail on the water quality monitoring that has been conducted over the years, I wanted to bring to your attention some of the results from monitoring of Green Lake inlets. I ask you to note the horizontal line, the red line along the bottom of the graph, if you can see it from back there. It's noted as 18 parts per billion of total phosphorus. The 18 parts per billion comes from the aforementioned Clean Water Partnership study, during which the water quality goal of Green Lake was listed as non-degradation. In order to meet this water quality goal of non-degradation, Green Lake must maintain average annual total phosphorus readings of 18 parts per billion or less. Now, these results are only from a few of the many inlets leading into Green Lake, and as you can see, in many of these cases, total phosphorus readings are in the hundreds. In all of these cases, Monitoring of the inlets paints a startling picture of total phosphorus inputs into Green Lake, and it indicates a real need for mitigation.
Mr. Anderson, could you explain to us what the colors are in the various bars of the graph? Because we can't read the small type from
Yes,
there.
Ma'am, Madam Chair. Basically, the different colors represent different sites from which samples were collected. Starting with the blue at the top, it's from the inlet from Nest Lake. Then we have an inlet from a slough. And we go around at various different inlets from around the lakes. In this particular graph, six different inlets.
And Mr. Anderson, Senator Fredrickson has a question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, could you convert that parts per billion to milligrams per liter for us?
Basically, 18 parts per billion is 0.018 milligrams per liter.
Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, would you say that again? 18 parts per billion?
Is equal to 0.018 milligrams. Parts per million or milligrams per liter.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Anderson before we let him continue?
Madam Chair, I'm still trying to understand that graph. So the red line is, what are you, you're just measuring phosphorus, and so you're looking at each inlet, how much phosphorus there is?
Basically, Madam Chair, Senator, these basically are average annual total phosphorus readings collected from a series of different samples throughout the course of the year, typically after rain events or snowmelt events. In these instances, in this particular graph, I'm presenting only the total phosphorus results. We also collected total set of suspended sediments as well.
And so as I understand the graph, your goal, if it's zero degradation to the lake, is to get those bars down to that horizontal.
Madam Chair, essentially our goal would be to get these results as low as possible, as low as we could possibly get them. Perhaps getting them down to 18 parts per billion for each individual inlet would not be a realistic goal. However, getting them as low as possible, and certainly lower than the hundreds readings that we're collecting now, is a goal.
So, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to. So some of the inlets are higher than others in the measurements that you're coming up with, obviously. So the blue one and the red one are very different, for example. And then the red line, is that testing elsewhere in the lake, or where does the baseline?
The actual baseline, are you referring to the 18 parts per billion or the horizontal line? That essentially is the non-degradation goal for Green Lake. So those actual samples collected on Green Lake would be collected at deep points within the lake itself.
So I guess I'm just, Madam Chair. So, okay, so you're measuring what the level is at the inlets, but I'm just wondering how to compare that with what else is going on in the lake. Do you have that? Are you getting to that? Or
Excuse me, I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Well, okay, you're showing what the levels are at the inlets, but I'm wondering how that compares with the levels in other parts of the lake.
Madam Chair, Mr. Senator,
Anderson.
We actually do collect readings around other parts of the lake in the deep points of the lake. Total phosphorus readings for now are maintaining at about 18 parts per billion, but we feel that the results from the inlets, whereby these results are contributing into the hundreds of total phosphorus, we feel that mitigation must take place in order to not exceed that 18 parts per billion around the lake.
Senator Fredrickson, did you have a question?
Madam Chair, he answered it with that last question.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I think, don't we have a standard for a wastewater treatment plant to discharge at one part per million of phosphorus?
1 milligram.
Do you know this? Or what? Isn't that one part per million?
I think that's what they were trying to do the math on.
1 milligram.
So if it's one part per million, and if I understand the 18 parts per billion, all those discharges into the lake are less than one part per million, right? So the water already going into the lake is already as clean as the water we expect to come out of wastewater treatment plants.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. But the point of this is that
these inlets are contributing to the milfoil in these particular areas. And that high level is what is, combined with other factors, are what is contributing to milfoil. That's the importance of this project. It's actually quite huge. It goes to the issue of invasibility that we've been discussing in the other environment committees. What happens when we create the environment for milfoil? If you remember when Green Lake was approaching the legislature for help in their milfoil in the past 2 years, they wanted to use LCMR funds to help herbicide their milfoil situation. I didn't support that, but I understood their concern. So they invited me out to take a pontoon ride to take a look at their milfoil. And they said, oh, look, at here are all our milfoil stands. And we rode around, and they said, oh, well, this is where a milfoil stand is. Oh, and by the way, there's a stormwater inlet. And then we rode to another one. And here's our milfoil stands. Oh, and here's a new housing development with green lawn and sand beach going all the way to the water. And then we went to another one, and oh, there's a stormwater inlet. And oh, there's our biggest stand, by the way, is right at our boat access where all the activity is. And I said, well, what's that little stream coming down off the edge of the residential area? Well, that's stormwater runoff coming off of that person's lawn. So I said, well, if you overlay the stands of milfoil with the stormwater inlets, do you notice anything interesting? And they said, where are you getting at? Well, when did this milfoil come about? It started about, really started to proliferate around 2001 or 2000. Well, what happened since then? Or around that time? Well, the county built a new road, and they added stormwater inlets. And so we went, kind of looked at each other and said, oh, well, this is just after the Healthy Lake Summit we had in Walker with the whole Dan Sines and all that, what we learned about invasibility. I said, is it possible that with all the activity and the in the stirring up the lake bed and the stormwater and the phosphorus coming in and fertilizing that stirred up area, that could be contributing to your milfoil? And maybe it would be better if we took a look at that issue instead of just trying to get the legislature and the DNR to fund more herbiciding efforts, which is just, it just leaves that plot. It's basically a plot of soil under the water, vacant for more invasives to come in. And so what these folks did was take that charge extremely seriously and went to the city council, the Citizens Lake Association. City council came up with a plan to immediately stop certain practices such as create more practices such as cleaning their streets more so all of that doesn't run off into the lake, and come up with a plan with the watershed district, the county, transportation department to start diverting this this phosphorus load, additional phosphorus load. And then with the help of engineers and scientists, researched the issue and found out that there is a correlation in other states with our stormwater and milfoil, and nutrient load and milfoil. And so they came up with this plan. It's going to take all sorts of different things, and the city has already passed ordinances. But here we have an opportunity to look at this issue of invasibility, creating the environment for invasive species, which is a water quality issue. and how we're actually contributing to the invasibility of our water. And this is it. This is the study to see if that actually holds true in Minnesota. We've had all the discussions in the policy committees and the finance committees about invasibility, but this is where we really are able to put the pedal to the metal in really figuring this out. And the project, the Green Lake folks, have come miles from where they were just a year ago in demanding that the DNR act to herbicide the milfoil and really actually get at the root of the problem. And by forming it into a pilot project, now we have the opportunity to apply what we learn here to the rest of the state. And so we're looking at solving this Green Lake issue, which was persistent, but really doing it the right way. And I think we have so many citizens who are in this area of the state that are now on what I feel is the right track towards truly addressing the issue in the long term. And it's going to benefit the rest of the state.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, perhaps somebody at the table can tell me what is a phosphorus level where there are not inlets, where there is not stormwater runoff?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator, as I mentioned previously, the Watershed District, in cooperation with Green Lake Volunteers, we do collect samples at two deep points within the lake itself. Those are not directly impacted by the inlets. They're a ways away from shore, that is. Those are at about 18 parts per billion currently.
Thank you.
Did you want to continue with your presentation?
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes.
Thank you. Heavy investments have been made into the protection of Green Lake's water quality, including county and property owner investments into a centralized sewage collection and wastewater treatment plant that goes around the lake. There are no longer individual septic systems on Green Lake. In addition to that, stormwater pretreatment along 14 miles of Highway 23, land donations and construction of stormwater ponds, monitoring and feasibility studies for potential corrective actions, as well as numerous person hours and volunteer time. Now, these efforts indicate a strong desire of local and state entities to do everything possible to continue protecting the lake. I'll take further measures to guarantee a greater return on the millions of dollars that have already been invested for the protection of the lake, which is why we are here today. Another indication of local willingness to protect the lake is with the Green Lake Property Owners Association, which has an extensive network of volunteers, including some who went through a DNR-approved training in order to actually scuba dive and manually remove some of the Eurasian water milfoil from some of the smaller patches. The strong desire of the Green Lake Property Owners Association to protect the lake has led to the aforementioned Green Lake Inlet Partnership. It's a very unique, very cooperative group comprised of so many different agencies and stakeholders. The partnership has been working since September of 2008 to investigate the most effective ways to address the nutrient sediment and Eurasian water milfoil issues affecting the lake. And this proposal is one of the partnership's results.
In addition, for the past 2 years...
Restate your name for the...
Oh, Jay Michaels. In addition, for the past 2 years, the Middle Fork Crow River Watershed District has been studying the problem, looking for opportunities to treat stormwater runoff before it enters the lake by using innovative stormwater management practices commonly known as low-impact development. The Watershed District has identified a series of improvements to the most problematic inlets and their contributing watersheds that, if installed, would dramatically reduce both sediment and nutrients feeding the lake and the Eurasian water milfoil. Combinations of these methods will be integrated into each design for each specific inlet to effectively treat the stormwater runoff before it enters Green Lake. These solutions include installation of bioretention or biofiltration cells, or very large rain gardens, as they're commonly known. These are used to filter and infiltrate stormwater runoff. The daylighting of pipes for surface treatment of runoff by filtering it in a vegetated swale before being discharged to the lake. and channel stabilization to reduce sediment and the associated nutrient loading. The Eurasian Water Milfoil Control consists of a thorough and consistent professional annual survey of the abundance and locations of the growth and control by approved methods consistent with the Green Lake Vegetation Management Plan. Another phase of our program consists of community education, teaching homeowners in the surrounding watershed what they can do in their own backyard to reduce sediment and nutrients from getting to the lake. To quantify the value of the improvements, we've also included an extensive pre- and post-construction monitoring and evaluation plan. Our budget for this project is $780,000. Our goal is to provide a benchmark for effective stormwater management and Eurasian water milfoil control that can be used throughout the state of Minnesota. The fiscal agent for the project is the Middle Fork Crow River Watershed District, who will also act as its administrative agent in cooperation with the Green Lake property owners, the City of Spicer, and Kandy, Ojai County. Technical support for the project will be provided by Emmons and Oliver Resources, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Transportation, the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water Soil Resources, and the Kandy-Ojai Soil Water Conservation District. The consequences to Green Lake of not taking action is the further degradation of water quality, the accelerated sedimentation and nutrient loading, and the proliferation of Eurasian water milfoil. It isn't often that we have a chance to save a lake.
Are there additional questions for the panel? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I see that on page 7, there's sort of a breakdown of where the money would go. And I'm trying to make sure I understand that in a little bit more detail. So the stormwater projects would consist primarily of these, I saw the rain gardens, the mega rain gardens that you're talking about along big areas. And what else would it include? Is it for that stormwater piece of it?
Basically, what we're trying to do is we're trying to disconnect the water coming from the first, second, third, fourth tiers of development that right now comes down the hill to the shore side of the road and then goes into an inlet, comes underneath the road that runs around the lake and then runs either via pipe or overland to the lake. What we'd be doing is doing the rain garden approach or the bioretention, biofiltration sort of approach at many of these inlets to try to soak the water in and control it before it's just coming in a straight pipe to the lake. In other areas, we've got vegetated swales where we can come in and we can establish, we can take a pipe that's running from the road and we can actually daylight that pipe. We can take the pipe out and run it through a vegetated swale to allow filtration in the vegetation. The third option, there are several very badly degraded channels that come from the second and third tier of development that are right now very steep and bare soil. And this would be channel stabilization in those areas to reduce the sediment that every time it rains, the banks are caving in. So we'd be stabilizing those channels to reduce the sediment and the associated nutrient loading for that.
And Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair. And let's see, you're Mr. Michaels?
Yes.
Okay. So is your plan to fix every stormwater inlet across in the whole lake in this project, or just some of them?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, no. We have identified there are actually 48 inlets around the lake. 32 of them have been affected by development. We are picking on the 12 worst. Worst providers of nutrients and sediment.
Okay. So, Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
a couple other question and also a comment. Senator Chaudhry talked a lot about, I guess his conclusion, he's not here, is that these inlets do, you know, that's where the milfoil comes from, that basically that's been proven, and I'm not sure whether you're proposing to us that you think that's already been shown to be the case and you're just trying to prevent it, or that you're trying to prove it or demonstrate it through this project. I don't know which one you're proposing to us.
Mr. Michaels.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, that's a very good question. And there's superficial evidence of this connection, of really written, documented evidence. The Lake Association has got a volunteer one every mile of shoreline, and they have been, over since the year 2000, have been watching the development of the Eurasian Water Milfoil. And I think I'm safe to say that anyone that's been involved in the program since 2000 will attest that there is a direct correlation between the nutrients coming in and those spikes that we saw on the graph that's causing the establishment, well, along with the sediment. There are studies that indicate the Eurasian water milfoil likes to take hold in that slimy sediment after it hits the lake. And that I think I'm safe to say that most everyone that has been watching this on Green Lake can make that correlation between what's coming in the stormwater inlets is helping the establishment of the Eurasian water milfoil.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Michaels, it seems to me we're in need of a controlled scientific experiment on this. I mean, this would be somewhat uncontrolled because you're not going to be able to cap every inlet in the lake. It'd be nice if you could, and then we could really see the before and after and see what would happen. I mean, it might lead to some improvements, but it sounds like we need a little more research on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Michaels.
We have extensive monitoring as a part of this that would start this summer as we are putting the final plans together for the construction of these inlets. Some of the inlets we've got years of monitoring on that we can see the direct effect. And actually, this is it's truly a benchmark project. We're addressing Eurasian water milfoil with this, but when we look at the number of lakes and that are impaired and in the TMDL process right now, this is stormwater management at its very best. This is a pilot study that we can take for any lake in the state of Minnesota and improve water quality.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I think you're right. This is a great set of proposals. I like them a lot, and I think there's no doubt that they've got to make a big impact. I just wanted to point out that I was just talking to our fiscal analyst about the economic recovery dollars, and it seems to me that this type of stormwater improvement fits squarely within those dollars that are available as well, and so that is something that we should look at, whether there's funding under the Clean Water Revolving Fund for wastewater or stormwater projects, and there's also a set aside for innovative green projects that go above and beyond normal ones, and you need to be on the regular list. Are you guys on that list?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we have spent extensive time looking at the stimulus package, and the major problem that we've got, and that was my initial reaction too, especially when the stimulus package comes down with a green infrastructure sort of approach to it, which we thought would be a natural for this project. The problem is Green Lake is too clean. Green Lake is not impaired at this point. If Green Lake had a TMDL in place or was even impaired, our point standing would be going up. I need to generate 45 points in the Pollution Controls Clean Water or the Revolving Fund in order to be considered as a part of that package. And I have a tough time making 5 points on their list. It seemed like a great thing until we looked deeply into it.
Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
that just begs more questions for me. I wonder. So, that's the PFA ranking system. I mean,
PCA ranking system.
That's the PCA ranking system, rather. Thank you. And I, we'll have to take a look at that and ask questions about that. But I was told last week by a number of groups that are working on the Clean Water Legacy Funds that they cannot use them for TMDL projects, which is kind of the opposite of what you're telling me. And so I think I'm hearing a lot of different, we need to get to the bottom of it and figure out what the facts actually are. So it sounds like you've done some checking. So we'll just follow up with the PCA and see if we can understand that better.
And Senator Anderson, in my conversations with Bowser, as they explained it to me, when lakes are assessed, they either do two things. They either create a plan to keep the lake clean or a plan to correct any degradation that may be occurring. I notice here in the bill that they are asking for the appropriation fund to go to Bowser. Does that how does that correlate with what you've been hearing?
Well, Madam Chair, they're not asking for the funds to come from the federal stimulus money. They're asking for it from the legacy dollars. So I guess that's kind of up to us to figure out where the money would come from and who would deliver it.
Are there other comments?
Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, or to any of you, on the $80,000 for survey and control of Eurasian water milfoil, are you planning to use any of that money for the traditional harvesting or chemical treatment of Eurasian water milfoil?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, our goal with the Eurasian water milfoil control program is to establish a thorough and consistent perpetual control program that annually we're studying and surveying the stands of milfoil within the lake. This is done by divers, and it's really the secret of successful control. Without the survey, the annual survey, we have a tough time identifying just where and how much herbicide treatment and other the hand control and diver control that we need to do.
Madam Chair, Mr. Michaels, well, I understand the survey part. My question is, are you going to use any of that money for chemical treatment or for harvesting of Eurasian milfoil?
Mr. Michaels.
Senator Fredrickson, yes, we are.
And are you going to try and use other methods of control also?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, we'll continue with the volunteer diver program. And also continue with the herbicide treatment as approved by the Green Lake Vegetation Management Plan, as outlined in the Vegetation Management Plan.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray, I think you had a question.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I was looking into your proposal for the budget, and it seems to me that the language does not include a report. My assumption is when you talk about prepare an evaluation of the pilot project, that includes kind of a report of progress. And it seems to me that 15,000 seems very low to really look at. You said that you only have 12 inlets, the worst. But my assumption is that you need to check on the others as well, because even though you might not be able to do it, you need to figure out if you are making progress only through the 12, or you need to incorporate more, and let us know. So I'm not clear about the 15,000, and I hope that in this process we are able to find out. This is a facetious comment, but I really hope so, that we are able to find out the use of water milfoil, so that we can advertise it, and then people will go and harvest this from all of our lakes and provide some funding for that. The best thing will be to find some good use for water milfoil. It will disappear from our lakes if we find that.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, some of us have actually said that in previous years, but, use it for biomass. But the problem is if you create a market for it, then people want it. That's the only problem. Then it's worth money. And so you create some strange incentives. But it's an interesting idea.
Senator Anderson, you had another question?
Yeah. I do have a question. I don't remember hearing about what the tree planting for hydrologic benefit proposal is.
Mr. Michaels?
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, the tree planting, there are more and more studies showing the benefits of trees. And primarily when we do bioretention areas and rain gardens, if you will, we're in vegetated swales. We're using native vegetation because of its deep roots. But in establishing in several of the areas, we've got situations where trees are the answer, and especially in the more urban sort of setting of downtown Spicer, where several of the potential projects that we've got, boat landings and things that are kind of in the mill with the DNR and the city, that we'd be using the trees as actually to soak up the stormwater, if you will, and using trees that establish quickly and are known as being high in evapotranspiration, so that they're pulling the water out of the ground. And I don't know this for a fact. It comes from an old friend who I sometimes question the credibility of his information. But at one point, we were looking at a big old willow tree, and he said, "You know, Jay, that'll soak up 700 gallons on a dry day in August." And I've done a little bit of research beyond that, and it would seem that he's not too far off. So when we take a look at establishing trees and the trees for stormwater usage, we're primarily looking for trees that'll establish quickly, that are high in evapotranspiration. Things like cottonwoods and willows and dogwoods, they're kind of the standards of stormwater management, but also river birch and linden and hackberry and several varieties of maple are all contributors to it. So it's just another tool in our toolbox, given the location and the project that we're working on.
I noticed that, is it Mr. Schneider, stepped to the table, and is there Ann Latham?
Latham. Yes, Ann Latham is
Did
here.
Did you want to come to the table?
May she be seated here, Your Honor. She's our reference.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Schneider, did you want to add some comments?
If I may, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm, as you know, Ron Schneider. I'm from Spicer, Minnesota. My family and I have lived on Green Lake since 1977. There's an issue here that I'd like to talk about a little bit, although you've heard quite a bit about it. Let me add this, if I may. The 18 parts per billion is significant because that's the point at which water becomes eutrophic. That's the point where you move from mesotrophic to eutrophic. That's the point where you end up with a biomass that is literally self-sustaining.
Mr. Schneider, you'll have to explain those two terms for me.
Mesotrophic and eutrophic. At the point where you're mesotrophic, which is what Green Lake situation is. I'm not a biologist, although I took some of it at Gustavus many years ago. But the fact is that at mesotrophic, you have a situation where the lake is in balance, if you will. It's not decaying, degenerating, and feeding itself and sustaining itself. When you reach the point where it is eutrophic, and that's the point where we'll see these algal runaways, if you will, where the lake explodes and gets green and the slough does the same thing. That's a eutrophic situation. That's the condition. It's one of the conditions, obviously, you want to avoid, because you don't have a lake then that is good for recreational purposes. And in some situations, it becomes toxic. And, of course, we all read about animals that die because of exposure to the water in that type of water. So I digress a little bit. I don't know if there are any questions about mesotrophic and eutrophic waters. I take it there aren't any further questions. We've made mistakes, a lot of them. And mention was made of the highway. No mention was made of farm tile drainage systems. I don't want to pick on farmers among us. I have a farm background. And so we have farm drainage systems that contribute to our dilemma. And years ago, before we installed our first sewer system, public sewer system on Green Lake, I recall at that point I was county attorney, and I recall our new county administrator, his first job was to get into a small aluminum boat and then travel from house to house on Green Lake and dump dye into the toilet, flush the toilet, and then walk out in the dock to see what the consequences were.
Mr. Schneider, we're going to be running out of time, so
okay,
we
I'm
need
sorry.
To get just, to the point.
Just wanted you to know what we've been doing. We've reached the point now where we are at the verge of being eutrophic. That's why that 18 parts per billion is so critical. This lake is in crisis. A lot of our lakes, rivers and streams, are in crisis. These, you might say this is yet another. This group that I'm with has gone even to the state of Idaho to pick up information on what they're doing insofar as protecting and improving lake water quality. We propose to do that, to save a lake, not allow it to get into an explosive crisis situation, but to do that, and we do beg this body here in St. Paul to help us with a dilemma that, as I say, is shared, we share with many others. But we have the will to do what we propose to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Are there additional comments from the panel or questions from the senators?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I think it was, I don't know much about the history of what's happened, but I think it was it was a visionary move to do what you've done. And so we need to do that on Moore Lake, so I appreciate that. And I've heard a lot about citizen monitoring of lakes before, but I've never heard of volunteer scuba divers. That's amazing. So I think you should really be commended on all the work that you're doing.
What I have one question, and I noticed that at the end of the bill you are suggesting that you'll prepare a report. Do you have any expectations of should these dollars come your way, do you have any expectations of what the outcomes will be? Have you got any idea at all that this is going to correct 10 of the 12, 6 of the 12 outlets? Anything at all that we can kind of say, well, this is worth $780,000?
Madam Chair, I have spent my entire life doing this, and I strongly believe that what we are proposing on those inlets on Green Lake is an avenue that we can take what we are going to study and monitor over the next couple of years, and we can show people around the state that this is really how we get at impaired lakes and impaired waters. It's disconnecting stormwater. And preconceived notions, no. I'm not setting any values out there that we're going to knock it from 700 down to 200 but I'm confident that we can show significant improvements and that this can be a benchmark for future projects like this around the state.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I would move the Senate file number 1249 be laid in the table and be considered for possible inclusion in the funding bill.
On that motion, is there any discussion? Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Ms. Latham has been seated there. I just think she should have a chance to say something since she came so far to be with us.
Thank you. Well, I can't tell you the thousands of hours that have gone into trying to keep this lake clean. Ron and I have spent probably millions. The goals here are pretty general. They're basically to at least, if not maintain the milfoil at the level it's at, hopefully reduce it and develop a program by which we can continually, perpetually keep it under control. And so we can do that by survey. You know, we have in place the ways to evaluate these things the outcomes. As far as predicting them, it'd be very difficult. We are intensely committed to reducing the sedimentation and the phosphorus. There's no sense in even going about this if we can't do that. And so we're confident that those things can be done, and those are our two goals. But I would like to say one other thing. One reason the clean water money was voted for in Minnesota is that there are a lot of lakes like us. We are so tired of hearing that we're not bad enough for help. And we want to keep our lake so that it doesn't get bad enough for help. And so I think you understand what I'm saying.
I say amen.
And that's the second time today I've
thank
heard.
You very much for the opportunity.
And I did
thank
hear that
you
earlier
for
today.
Giving the citizens of Minnesota the opportunity to do some of these things that haven't been done and can't be done any other way.
We appreciate all of you coming down here. Other comment or discussion on the motion to put the bill on the table for possible inclusion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Dempsey. You're up. The next item on our agenda is Senate File 1275. Senator Anderson is bringing us a bill about the beneficial reuse of wastewater grant program appropriations.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Senator Anderson.
This is Senate File 1275, and I believe Senator Rosen is now a co-author on this bill, and I want her to be a co-author on this bill if we haven't added her yet. This bill is a statewide request for grants to political subdivisions around the state to do some really innovative wastewater treatment reuse of water. And this is about trying to find good uses of that water that comes out of our wastewater treatment plants instead of using groundwater to run an industrial process or other process. So the effort is to try to recycle our water and to use that for purposes for which you need water. And I have two people who want to talk. I have staff from the LCCMR who would like to talk about some research that we had done in the LCCMR about the possibilities of recycling treated municipal wastewater for industrial use. And I have Senator Rosen here who has an actual example of that in her district, which is very unique, very innovative, and relates specifically to the ethanol industry where we've heard so much. You know, it's been sort of the poster child of people's concerns about using a lot of groundwater. And Senator Rosen has an ethanol plant that is trying to recycle water instead. And so I want her to talk about that, and then maybe we'll have, do you want to start? And then we'll have the LCCMR staff talk about the research that's been done on this.
Senator Rosen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Senator Rosen. I'm wearing my hat as the, unfortunately, Mr. Keith Kaur from Corn Plus in Winnebago was not able to be here, so I'm wearing my ethanol hat. But I just want to thank Senator Anderson for bringing this bill forward. It's extremely important, and it's exactly the direction that we need to go with when we're talking biofuels or industrial use for wastewater. And Senator Anderson knows Corn Plus very well because this is a unique 50 million gallon ethanol plant that has been doing some very innovative things when it comes to their energy use. And they have a corn fluid bed energy source. They heat up their corn syrup, and that's how they heat their ethanol plant. And if it wasn't for Senator Anderson, I don't think they would have been able to get the two wind turbines on the ethanol plant. So you have a renewables servicing a renewable. And it's the first time ever that's happened. Alliant Energy kind of beat me up on that a little bit, but we got it through. And it was fascinating. And now Keith Core, brought this to my attention to use the Winnebago's wastewater, and they just discharge about 350,000 gallons a day, and that's approximately what the Corn Plus ethanol plant needs a day. So, and by chance, the Free Press just had this article, or I believe you might have this,
yes.
That they wrote just yesterday about this bill and this project, and it would be the first ethanol plant to ever use wastewater as their water source, and it's the perfect win-win situation for, like I said, the direction we want to go. There would be some treating that would be applicable on this, and they haven't gone the path as far as the PCA yet, but they all indicators say that this is going to work if we can just get that mile stretch from the wastewater treatment plant to Corn Plus because it sits right on the edge of town. And with that, I mean, I am just so proud of this little ethanol plant. They are the first ones to be on the Chicago Climate Exchange. They're exchanging carbon credits. They even sold some. They're always thinking forward, and I would just really love to see this project move forward for them and to set an example not only for the, like I said, the biofuels industry, but also for industrial, the industrial arena too. So.
And Senator Rosen, are they also making money?
Well, that's a good question, Madam Chair. They are not making money at this point, but they are doing various things to get, like they use only 17,000 BTU to produce per gallon to produce their ethanol, where most other ethanol plants are using 32 to 34,000 BTUs. their gallons that the average the ethanol plants of water that they're being used is 3 to 4 gallons per gallon of ethanol, and they'd like to get that down to 2 gallons. And I could go into there's the RIN, which is the renewable identification number from the EPA. It's a registration number, and if you can receive that for developing cellulosic ethanol, which they do because they have that corn bed fluid heater, they can earn another $500,000 a month from the feds on that. So they have had some very profitable years, but with the price of corn, mm-hmm. and there is some competition, but they are a smaller ethanol plant, so they have to be innovative. They can't mm-hmm. compete with the big boys out of sheer scale and size, but they're going to be okay. It's farmer owned, Madam
I just
Chair.
Wanted that good story about doing the right thing pays off.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, they're kind of in a slump right now, but that's what gives them the innovation, Madam Chair, to keep going
sure.
and to recreate their energy needs and how they do business. So,
well, Madam Chair, I think that over the long run, it probably will get more expensive and more difficult to use groundwater in large quantities to fuel those kinds of plants. And so it seems to me we need to, I mean, the incentive should be to reward a company that does the right thing and that
Absolutely.
Is trying to be the greenest producer that they can be. And there are some incentives that already reward that in terms of, you know, having carbon credits, et cetera. So they're using, you know, their ethanol that they produce has less carbon content because of them using renewable sources of fuel. And it makes sense that they should also be rewarded for recycling the water that they use. That's just a fantastic example. So I think it would be great if we could, this type of funding could be available to encourage to support them and to encourage other projects like this around the state to demonstrate that it's viable. So maybe we should ask our LCCMR staff to talk a little bit about that, because they oversaw the research that was done on this. Susan Thornton and Shelley Schreffler. I'm not sure who's going to speak. Both of you? Okay.
Ms. Thornton?
Madam Chair and members, Susan Thornton, with Director of the LCCMR, Legislative Citizen Commission, Minnesota Resources. And I was asked to come in to inform some of the members of the subcommittee and remind some of the members of the subcommittee about a study that was done, funded by the legislature as recommended by the LCMR. It was funded in the 2005 legislative session for $300,000 from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund for recycling treated municipal wastewater for industrial water use. And this initiative came out of discussions by the commission of looking around, casting around for alternative ways that we could look at to reduce our water consumption. And so the intent of the study was to look at the opportunity for using recycled treated municipal wastewater for industrial use, characterize what those industrial uses might be, characterize what is the demand, water demand and supply and quality, and determine the cost to possibly treat various municipal wastewater discharges and to meet those specific industrial uses, specifically at what differing plants and what industries are nearby that the water would need to be treated in such a way to be able to have that industry use that water, wastewater discharge. And the study was done by the Metropolitan Council in cooperation with DNR, PCA, Department of Health, as well as industry stakeholders and the wastewater utilities. And many other parts of this country were already doing wastewater recycling, but there was not the incentive out there in this state. We have been doing some wastewater recycling, typically for some power generation, golf course irrigation, that type of thing. So in their analysis, and we did not do the analysis, the Metropolitan Council and consultants and the stakeholders were in on the analysis. Basically, the conclusions, and you've got the executive summary in your packets, are that we do have the technology, we do have the proximity, and there were recommendations that there would need to be possibly some financial incentives earlier up front to enable the reuse of these water supplies, this new water supply, and that actually some of the treatment processes may actually assist in meeting some of the TMDL requirements being met by that need to be met by some of these facilities. One of the main costs they discovered for treatment might be for certain industries would be because of the high chloride levels. So hard water and high chloride levels, that would be often an additional treatment process. Many of these industries require a certain level of water quality for their processes, so they have to be assured that there is that reliable water supply if they're going to use an alternative source of water other than groundwater, for instance. So very briefly, members, I went through that. As I said, the summary is in your packet. Any specific questions, we might try and answer them, but we can also call up the people who did this study and get back to you with some specific answers.
Other questions from the committee? Ms. Sarton, when you talked about the quality of the water that some of these industries would the wastewater treatment plant have to make sure the water is sufficiently clean, or would the industries have to install some kind of filters or mechanisms to make sure the water met their needs?
Madam Chair, members, it might take both processes to, but initially this was really looking at with what the water specs are of those industries, how the treatment at the facility could meet those water specs.
And Senator Anderson, I noticed that the bill says that 50% of the cost to pre-design and implement capital projects. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, but this is, this bill last year was introduced and was in the bonding bill, and I think we left some of that language over from the bonding bill, and perhaps we could, we don't know, need that exact terminology. But it was actually in the Bonney bill. I believe the governor vetoed it. It was a, I can't remember the amount. Maybe we had 500,000. I can't remember.
It was the same amount.
Oh, it was the same amount. Okay, and I don't know that there, I never heard that there was any particular objection to it. I think it was just whatever, for whatever reason. So I don't, so we thought we'd try it with the clean water funds this year because it seemed like a good use for that.
But did you want to leave it at 50%? In other words, the industries that are going to take advantage of this money would have to match?
Well, I think that's reasonable, Madam Chair, to have a match.
How many industries are interested, or have you heard from other industries that are interested in taking advantage of this kind of technology? Do we have any sense of that?
Madam Chair, I don't think we really know. And maybe the Met Council has, it may be somewhere in that report, and we could check with the Met Council to see if they surveyed and got a sense. I don't know. Not the only one that's come forward since this was introduced was Senator Rosen and her plant in her district that is very aware of this issue. And so I'm not sure. Ms. Thornton said that there are a few uses of this already around the state in a few circumstances, but I think it's oh, okay. We have, thank you. The examples that we have, this is as of 2004, are, wait a minute, water use? This is just water use.
Yeah, but they surveyed them.
Okay, but the, all right, this doesn't tell us who might use it. Okay, they surveyed industries that are within 4 miles of a wastewater treatment plant, and we have some of those lists. And what the amount of water usage is at some various industries. So there's a wealth of information in here. And I'm not sure if the specific... Go ahead, if you want to...
Madam Chair and members, in general terms, agricultural processing, other industrial processing for cooling, metal processing, non-metallic processing, power generation is a very large user of our groundwater, sand and gravel washing, steam power cooling. Those are some of the examples of the industries that they worked with and surveyed. Cannon equipment, Semstone products. We can get back to Met Council and see what the follow-up, an additional follow-up that they did. I also know that, in particular, they were working with Coke Refinery, Flint Hills Resources, as to what their water needs might be.
Senator Fredrickson, you had a question?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, this language is more specific to bonding, as you said, and it would seem to me that you would not need to keep pre-design in that if we just say design. And I'm also wondering if we need to say capital if we just say design and implement projects that use, because capital has a certain... certain expectation of what
statute that way
of what
Mr. Knopf, you
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson and Senator Anderson, this is kind of modeled also after the statute where it basically says 50% of the cost to pre-design design capital projects to demonstrate the beneficial use of wastewater. So it does follow the statutory, when you see the reference on 1.8 to section 116.195. So it's just using the similar language as to what's in the statute. And that is, those are what those grants are eligible for under that statute.
Which, Madam Chair, which grants?
The
municipal wastewater treatment grants?
Mr. Knopf?
No. Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the beneficial use of wastewater grants.
So there's already grants.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, in the bonding bill last year, they had $2.5 million for this program. They also created a statute, and that's what you have referenced in your bill. And that statute talks about capital projects. It basically says the agency shall make grant awards to political subdivisions for up to 50% of the cost to acquire, construct, install, furnish, and equip capital projects that demonstrate the beneficial use of wastewater. And there's a maximum grant of $500,000.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Anderson,
and I didn't realize that the statutory language had been passed. So we could certainly, I think it kind of makes sense to take out pre-design and capital, the words that are in there. But we should make it conform with the statute. We should maybe make the statute conform with this. And I'm not sure that we would want to limit this just to municipalities. You know, I would think that if there was an industry that wanted to use this, it should be eligible for one of these grants because they might be financing it themselves. It may be the municipality that's financing it, but I think it should be available to and I don't know in Corn Plus's circumstance if they're going to go through their city to try to request funding or not, but it makes sense that maybe we should revise this language a little bit.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think the reason they had political subdivisions is because of bonding and it would have to be public sites. What you may want to think about doing is just leaving that program alone and just specifying how you want it to be used, this appropriation to be used.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking. Madam Chair, maybe we should...
Senator Anderson.
Maybe we should just be really general at the moment, and we can always change it, but perhaps we could say for grants and just take out the statutory reference and just say for grants... for projects. That's how most of these are drafted. For grants for projects that use treated municipal wastewater instead of groundwater, et cetera. Does that work? Madam Chair, I guess I'm a member. I'll move that amendment.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, I don't know if I'm hearing this correctly. So we already passed some legislation to do this.
Madam Chair,
we're asking for...
But there's no money.
Oh, there was no money.
The money was
vetoed.
So
the language is there, but we didn't put money into it. Okay,
exactly.
Thanks.
And I think it does make sense. That was based on bonding, and it makes sense to just make this, not have to fit a square peg into that round hole.
On Senator Anderson's motion, any further discussion? Those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Other discussion on the bill? Senator Anderson, did you want to move your bill?
Sure, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the LCCMR staff and thank Senator Rosen for coming and speaking in support of this as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
If I could come back sometime, Madam Chair, and just give you an update on this, if this works for Corn Plus, I'd love to be able to tell you how this worked and their energy costs and what they've been able to do with this whole groundwater issue or the wastewater issue. And it would be fun to give you an update.
That would be really welcome.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, there are a couple ethanol plants that are recycling a portion of their water, too. If they're interested in dropping it below 2 gallons, they might take a look at that.
Senator Anderson moves to lay Senate File 1275 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Is that correct? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you all very much. There being no more business before us, the committee is adjourned.
We don't put it back to the state of COVID.
Gotta get that line.